Welcome to this Catholic Theological Union podcast, featuring a lecture by Father John Markey, OP, titled Notes from the Road More Traveled, Doing Theology in a U.S. Cultural Context. Dr. Markey is introduced by CTU Professor Emeritus Stephen Bevins, SVD. This talk was recorded at CTU on Monday, October 12, 2015, for the annual Louis J. Luzbatek SVD Lecture on Mission and Culture.
It's really my pleasure this afternoon to introduce to you John Markey. John is a priest in the Dominican Order, or the Order of Preachers. He's currently Associate Professor of Theology at the Oblate School of Theology in San Antonio, Texas. And he's also the director of Oblate's PhD in spirituality. John has an MA in theology from the University of Notre Dame. That's where we met when I was a doctoral student there. John was an undergraduate there and went on to do his MA together with Paul Coleman here, who is also traveled a little far from the University of Notre Dame to be here. He's John's classmate. He has a PhD from the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, writing his dissertation with the great Jesuit theologian Donald Gelpy. John has published many, many articles and published two books. One was on communion ecclesiology, where he engaged especially the American philosopher Josiah Royce. And a second book just published last year called Moses in Pharaoh's House, A Liberation Spirituality for North America. And that's what he's going to kind of talk about today. John has also taught several courses here at CTU over the years, in person, in the classroom, and also a blended course online. Now, as Roger said, this is his first Luzbatek lecture to preside over. It's my last. And so I thought in inviting the Luzbatek lecture this year, I'd indulge myself by inviting one of my dearest friends, someone who I love and respect deeply, to deliver this lecture. But believe me, this is no idle indulgence. John Markey is an incredibly astute theologian. We talked about 4 hours last night, and we, you know, solved all the theological problems of the world. I think John has read almost everything there is to be read. It's just amazing. And he has a wonderful way of making some of the most complex things really understandable for his students or for lesser lights like myself, I think. John's very committed to working out an understanding of the church's mission in contemporary mainstream North American culture. And this is what he's going to share with us today. So, a great friend, a brilliant theologian, let's warmly welcome John Markey.
I wish Steve hadn't started with that. It just ended with it instead. It would have been, well, anyway. Well, I really am grateful to be here today because I have the same appreciation and love for Steve and for CTU. So both are really important places in my life. And so this is a great opportunity. I called the... So here's what we have to do tonight. Because I don't have enough time, I have to read the text. Because otherwise, it just goes on and on. So I have to stay with what I decided before I got here. And that this is an open-ended, this is an unfinished text. I mean, it's the beginning of a book, the next book in a sense, and it's meant to hopefully provoke some response and conversation among colleagues. So it's written with the idea that I'd be happy for anyone here to say I'm wrong or to help me understand more deeply some aspect of this that I'm just, again, early in some ways working on, only written one book on it so far. So it's called Notes from the Road More Traveled, Doing Theology in a U.S. Cultural Context. One of the most significant consequences of Vatican II has been the worldwide effort at enculturation and contextualization of the Christian tradition, particularly at the level of foundational theology and method. This process implies drawing on a unique pattern of thought, social structures, cultural narratives, and rituals to develop new theological and pastoral sensibilities. This process, termed prophetic dialogue by our eminent hosts this evening, Steve Bevins and Roger Schroeder, seems to be dramatically underway practically everywhere in the Roman Catholic world, in particular is what I want to address tonight. But this process of prophetic dialogue is going on everywhere in the world that I can find, except mainly the United States. While Hispanic and Latinos, African Americans, Asian Americans, feminists, etc., have continually served, even in the U.S., the only ones in the U.S. with an awareness of the needs for contextualization, Euro-American academic and ecclesial theology has largely failed to analyze, articulate, and critique its own U.S. cultural context and engage in a serious evangelical and theological dialogue. In this lecture, then, I offer or propose what I believe are four significant insights about the task of enculturation and contextualization as it relates particularly to Euro-American theology in the church and academy in the coming decade in the U.S. So my first insight is on liberation, or I call it specifically liberating the USA. Although Euro-American theologians awfully greatly appreciate and are deeply conversant in liberation theology and its many global variations, they seem to be virtually unaware of ways in which the cultural context of the U.S. itself needs to be liberated. Liberation theology began as a response to of economically poor and politically oppressed peoples to their condition, and as a reaction to the ideology that supported and enabled the institutional structures of those conditions. Any theology of liberation is inherently rooted then in the experience of the poor, the marginated and oppressed peoples, and their struggle to interpret theologically their struggle and their desire for new life in the midst of suffering and death. Obviously, I'm just quoting Gutierrez. Liberation theology, while beginning in Latin America, has come to represent all those who find themselves in what he calls the scandalous condition in history, the victims of institutional oppression, violence, injustice, and inequity that it permeates the world in which we live. Liberation theology finds its deepest yearnings and hopes in the biblical story of a God who hears the cry of the enslaved Hebrew people and demands that they be set free. What I'm proposing, on the other hand, other than liberation theology, is a theology for those who actually are living not in enslaved conditions, but in Pharaoh's house. What I mean by this is I believe that we need a liberating theology for those who find themselves on the inside of oppressive structures of the wealthiest countries, much like Moses in the Exodus story initially found himself living inside Pharaoh's house. I mean, the great quote that I use in my book from Hebrews 11, Moses by faith knew that he was not Pharaoh's daughter's child, but that his true destiny lie with the people of Israel. But it took him an act of conversion to realize he was not Pharaoh's daughter's child, and that his true destiny lie with the people of Israel. So I think, like Moses, most of us have no intention of being oppressors. But that's precisely the problem. We live very confined and ultimately unreflective lives where we take much for granted about the way things are. The gospel imperative of the option for the poor requires us instead to see things the way they ought to be. An important part of breaking this cycle of oppression is actually motivated largely through empathy, right? The power to see the world according to the reign of God and begin desire, and with a desire to first want to live in that world here and now. The question must arise then, what kind of theology needs to be done by and for those who do not suffer from institutional injustice, but in fact are the beneficiaries of it? I propose that we don't need then as much a theology of liberation in the U.S. as a theology of conversion. The majority of the citizens of the United States primarily need to be converted, not from, by the way, I'm going to get to this, not from non-belief to belief, but from a cultural ethos that leads them to believe that self-centered individualism, unfettered free market capitalism, and fundamentalistic religious piety are not only morally acceptable, but are in fact divinely given and necessary for salvation. Members of the entitled beneficiaries of this group need new, are these people who belong to these countries need new eyes and new ears so that they can see and hear and experience the world in a radically different way. The way that the majority of outsiders, social, political, and almost always economic people or economic conditions, experience life on a daily routine, as part of their daily routine. This task then requires, first of all, a process of holistic and integral personal spirituality that enables a radical reorientation of life. This spirituality can be characterized as a process of personal and social conversion that liberates Americans from an entire false value system that calls good evil and evil good, that enmeshes them in lives where they are often oppressing and violating the rights of entire parts of the world without even realizing it. In North American church, many theologians are only slowly coming to realize that the 2,000-year-old tradition of Christianity developed almost entirely outside of the relatively new and still emerging U.S. cultural milieu. To engage American culture with the gospel, acutely challenging it, is complicated because most people, including theologians and church leaders, are unaware of how deep this problem is. U.S. culture, I mean, here's my basic thesis, right? Most people in all the Europeans just think we're a suburb of Europe. I mean, every time you go to a meeting in Rome, that's all they think. We're just a suburb of Europe. But a lot of U.S. theologians think the same thing. You know, they engage mainly European sources, European cultural critiques, European analysis, and they don't ever seriously engage or think about the cultural tradition that they themselves, many of them, emerge out of. Something that, by the way, would never be done in the Philippines now, or would never be done in many parts of Africa or South America. If you had 250 years of literature, political commentary, philosophy, theology, historical differentiation of even within particular traditions like the Catholic tradition, you wouldn't just ignore it and study a French philosopher to understand American culture. So it's interesting for me that's precisely where a lot of U.S. theology comes from. Not, now I said, there's a certain group of people that in fact have moved away from this, but in the mainstream, you still see that the modes of analysis and understanding of our theology still often derive from a continent that we've been separated from literally and politically and even economically for over 250 years. So grasping the subtlety and the complexity of U.S. culture is different, and it's like every enculturation or contextualization process, it's unending. Enculturation in the U.S. context will require that theologians understand its own unique traditions, the rich countercultural context of most U.S. communities, and the myriad of both contradictions and variations in the forms of cultural expression. The predominant mainstream ethos of American life has emerged out of a unique set of historical, social, economic, and geographic circumstances that create this culture even as it's in the process of being transformed. Awareness of this dynamic process is critical for any theology that truly wants to penetrate and evangelize persons living at the heart and even in the peripheries of the United States. But where should we begin this process? Christian theology has often sought to initially understand and interpret a society through engagement with its philosophical sources. This is, of course, a Euro bias. But I think that this can be a really fruitful entry point in the U.S. Because in the U.S. cultural history, philosophy, the project of thinking publicly, philosophy was a public project until the Second World War. I mean, when William James would write an article on first drafts of the varieties of religious experience, they were published on the front page of the New York Times. Philosophy from Jefferson and Emerson, everything Emerson wrote was memorized in his own lifetime. So these people were serious. They weren't marginalized like contemporary philosophers who, you know, nobody even knows who, in the schools we work in, nobody even listens to us. In the theology department, no one listens to us. So, you know, being a philosopher is just next to being invisible, you know. But in the early and even into the middle part of this century, people like John Dewey and Reinhold Niebuhr, these were public intellectuals who were rooted in a theological and philosophical tradition that was uniquely U.S. It emerged out of our own traditions. And so there's this very famous handful of public intellectuals who shaped the way that U.S. people see reality. But more important, there's so many lesser-known scholars in the academy and outside of it. A lot of these people were, a lot of the most famous early and most influential early scholars in American life, from our literature people and poets and our artists, they had day jobs, including our philosophers. And so they reflected early on this emerging American ethos and tried to shape and define it, or at least critique it in a way that those who had power could shape or change it. Many of these early American intellectuals intuitively grasped that the American experiment was new and interesting and significant, and understood its deeper and more serious implications for both the future of this nation and humankind. Furthermore, the U.S. intellectual tradition also is comprised of a unique and indigenous modes, as I said earlier, theology, literature, poetry, political commentary, legal history, social theory, literary theory, etc., stretching back over almost 250 years. What I'm suggesting then is what, so let me get to the point of this, what, la la la. Okay, what Bevins is, you know, this whole thing is one, I realized only last night, you know, this is everything I do in some ways in this is a commentary on Steve's book, right? Models of Contextual Theology. So here it is. So I think that really the best starting point, method that we should engage is what Bevins calls the synthetic method, the synthetic model of contextualization. I think this is a great starting and largely overlooked starting point. I believe that this is in fact the one major approach that's already being used, especially in the Hispanic Latino community and in the African American community, of theological community. And it offers rich and potential sources to all kinds of other contexts. The synthetic model, which Bevins also refers to as the dialogical or analogical method, envisions a kind of creative dialogue between sources within the culture that resonate with the gospel message, as well as with parts and places in the culture that have already analyzed and offered a critical reflection on certain aspects of the culture. And with remember the other thing about these cultural sources, they're a lot of time emerging out of dynamic alternatives to the mainstream culture, and reactions and reflections, prophetic reactions and prophetic engagement already with the culture. So this model of contextualization has been attempted on small scales by various theologians and critics over the last 50 years. And, you know, I myself am part of a movement we used to meet every summer. There were about 10 or 12 of us called the John Courtney Murray Study Group. And we studied, and we had a study group actually at the Catholic Theological Society meeting called North American Contextual Theology, which only we ever attended. So, and Steve. But you know, what we started doing in the 90s was we started having joint sessions. We had three joint sessions with the African American Contextual Theology Group and three sessions with the Hispanic Latino, Contextual Theology Groups. And we also had two with the Liberation Groups. And so, in other words, they were really interested in what we were doing. We even had Cornel West at one of our meetings who was interested in what we're doing. He wanted us to talk about theology and wanted to talk with us about theology. So, and in that group that I studied with, some of the most prominent people, Don Jalpi was kind of the Potter doctor, the old founder of it. But, I mean, some other interesting people were part of it. Bill Spohn, Alex Garcia Rivera, and my colleague and friend Nancy Pineda Madrid, all hail from this movement and have been doing theology for 25 or 30 years out of this synthetic model. So that's one thing I'd like to suggest. Secondly, I can't talk about U.S. context without taking on my great nemesis in cultural discourse, postmodernism. So I propose, here's my proposal, U.S. culture is hypermodern rather than postmodern. So I'll try and explain what that means. The Constitution of the Church and the World describes the world largely, the Gaudium's best, the Vatican document, describe the world largely in terms of change. That's what they called the modern world, modernity. Change primarily from a stable social order through dynamic growth in industry and technology that literally created a fluid and unstable social, political, and economic environment as the normative condition of a new era called modernity. There was also a dramatic change at the roots of the society in terms of the role of the church and religion in the social ethos. With the dawn of the Enlightenment in Europe, European society became relatively secular and fundamentally reoriented towards the ideals and thought forms of scientific theory as the foundational pattern or the way in which they chose to view the world. Modernity connotes the experience of a society that believes, though, in the positive value of change. As a matter of fact, they believe in change itself and sees in it the hope of progress, growth, and development of a higher standard of living for themselves, but also, in a sense, and often for everyone else. Modernity is a type of culture in itself, values change then for its own sake, understanding both the immense possibilities and even the dangers inherent in this phenomena. Nevertheless, modern culture accepts the inevitability of change in light of the technological, social, and political forces that science and economic demands as non-negotiable parts of life that simply have to be adjusted to or understood. I contend that in many ways, Gaudium's Best is still a helpful guide in the U.S. cultural context, precisely because the U.S. is in milieu, I think we're struggling not with postmodernity as much as coming to terms with our own unique type of modernity. So, in many parts of Europe, scholars and commentators feel they're no longer experiencing modernity. They feel like they're in a new era that they describe as postmodernity. Similarly, I'd argue in the United States, We're not really a modern culture exactly either, but we're not postmodern. We haven't given up on modernity. We're experiencing our own variation on this cultural pattern that I call hypermodernity or hypermodernism. European commentators almost inevitably describe postmodernism as a radical break with the Enlightenment, sense that there's order, purpose, and direction to the world that can be known and controlled through human intelligence and cooperation. For Europeans, the 20th century first created a crisis for the world, for the worldview of progress, and then it shattered it altogether with the tragedies of the 20th century in Europe, the rise of totalitarian states, two world wars, the Holocaust, an ideological Cold War that plunged the whole of the world, but especially Europe, into that was exhausted into an ethos of standing on the edge of nuclear abyss for 40 years. So postmodernism connotes the attempt to pick up the pieces and shape a new and less ambitious view of reality after the demise of the myths of modernism. Postmodernism rejects as naive and optimistic a modernism that uncritically accepted the notion that progress and growth were necessary and almost always good, and that science and economics were positive forces underlying and guiding the change itself. Postmodernism is skeptical not just of religion, but of other dimensions of the stable order that modernism supplanted. It's skeptical of modernism itself. It's skeptical of the institutions of economics. It's skeptical of science. And it feels that, in fact, not only are they trying to find a new worldview, a foundational way of thinking that can help replace the old order, they're skeptical that any such foundational worldview could ever be recovered or that we want it to be recovered. So that's what I would say is the kind of notion of postmodernism. In the U.S., in many ways, first of all, and I won't go through this, but the U.S., modernism begins in the U.S. in a different way. It has a lot to do with the changes that happen in the U.S. between 1800 and 1840, that you see this, and I attribute this work to Albert Borgmann, Crossing the Postmodern Divide, a very important U.S. Cultural philosopher and thinker. And he says, you know, that basically U.S. modernism begins somewhere around 1840, that until then we're largely still not Enlightenment modern in the way that Europe is, that we're not industrialized. We don't have a break. We certainly don't have a break with religion as an institution. It's the opposite, right? In the first centuries of the U.S. and the whole continent. I'm not just talking about the East Coast, but in the West Coast too, and other parts of the society. So it's a unique enough cultural moment in the 1840s to 1850s. That Alex Tocqueville could come here from France and discover something new was going on, and he described it as modernity, like they're having a modern moment, you know. And so we're having modernity emerge in the next 100 years, right as Europe is like had enough of modernity, right? That's it. Let's stop with that. So I'd argue that we create a unique type of modernity that's really quite distinct from European modernity. And like its European counterparts, I do think that America is experiencing a kind of cultural crisis, but it's quite different from the exhaustion and the project of postmodernism. I believe that it's more adequate to describe U.S. culture as being hypermodern. And by that, I don't mean that American forms of modernism has broken down or failed. On the contrary, hypermodernism asserts that American modernism has succeeded all too well. Its very success has, in fact, created the crisis that American culture now confronts. With the development of a new and more refined levels of technology, the speed of growth has begun to outstrip the human ability to adapt to the environmental, biological, and psychological changes that it brings. As this new world yielded increasingly efficient systems of economic success, efficiency itself morphed into an ideology that now serves as the measure of all things, from government to education, to medical care and even religion. The U.S. triumph in the decade-long Cold War led not to the dissolution of meta-narratives, but actually cemented a naive trust in free market capitalism as the default foundation of the larger U.S. meta-narrative that we often refer to as U.S. exceptionalism. So what I think is that U.S. or American modernism is largely characterized by three primary aspects or values: individuality, growth, and efficiency. Individuality, growth, and efficiency. And so far in this point in time from those values being discarded or discredited, they've in fact, as I say, succeeded all too well. To now, we live in a society that holds them to actually be the way reality is, or the way that we measure reality is how well the society meets the needs of individuals, how efficient it is, and how much it grows. In every way, growth is possible, right? And so I think that, and again, I in the interest of time, I'm not going to go into too much detail on this, but I think that, so U.S. modernism, instead of being kind of, what's happened now is we're into a kind of hyper-individualism and hyper-efficiency. As I said, efficiency is the way you determine everything's value. You know, everything, including religion, its value is how efficient it is, how well it delivers outcomes, how well it can, and using a very economic model of evaluating things, that how well do they do what they're supposed to do, et cetera. And so growth, and of course growth is literally about growth, meaning not just economic growth, but growth of the size of my house, right? The size of my bedroom, the size of my bed. I mean, even in religious life, I know a lot of us are there. Believe me, as we go on in life, Tom O'Meara, who's not here, but who was one of my early mentors in religious life, a Dominican, said, in religious life, I gave everything up for the Lord, and I've spent the last 50 years of my life taking it all back, right? And so that it's just so much part of U.S. culture, right, the growth of taking and acquiring. And so I think that oddly that, so for instance, an example I would give of the hyper notion of that's really dangerous is something like hyper individuality, which happens in U.S. culture, where it's not, one of the most fascinating things that all these great kind of studies in the 1980s and 90s, like by Robert Bella and Robert Putnam and Roger Wuthnow and others, they kept discovering that the most potent desire of individuals, people, as young people, at that point, I think we were Generation X, before the millennials, whatever that was, they really wanted community. That was their big goal. That was the thing that everyone sought or desired. But the problem is you wanted it on your own, everyone wanted it on their own terms. And they wanted it to meet their needs, that they were so exhausted from growth and efficiency that they wanted a place, a community, to be precisely that place that kind of freed them up from the need to do anything, right? It gave them, it was kind of meant to be therapeutic. And not therapeutic in the good way, kind of more like palliative therapy, right? Makes me feel better without actually making me better. Because again, we would think in the Christian tradition that the only kind of community that can make me better is the one that challenges me to be a different kind of person, one who becomes more like Christ. But that's work. That's actually not therapeutic. It feels very untherapeutic. How many of us in religious life, or in not just religious life, but in the work and the life of the church or something, pray each year that we don't have any growth? I don't. I'm for no growth. I want my human psyche is exhausted from growth and efficiency and wants a place where there isn't. But that isn't true. But instead, the solution to that challenge of hypermodernity's, the exhaustion of the individual, was to look for more efficient ways to create community. In other words, we turned to an economic model of efficiency and growth that became an industry, right? I have a cousin who's the president of Gaiam, which makes yoga mats. It's one of the fastest growing companies in the world, right? And so, in other words, it is helping people relax, but they have to keep buying new things, right? The goal, the key to their relaxation is to keep purchasing the improved yoga mats that Gaiam comes out with every 3 years that are exactly like the old ones, as far as I can tell. So one of the problems then is that people can self-identify in this process a problem like hyper-individualism. People see that, they realize they want social bonds, they want a sense of deep connectedness with not just other people, but with a tradition and with a past, etc. But the problem is that the way they do that is they turn to a kind of a society that believes so much in individual self-expression and personal growth that community itself becomes almost impossible if the reason I'm in it is to make myself better. So the quandary, as I say here, I better get back to the text. The quandary in contemporary hyper-modern America is that individuals seek and need communal and social experiences to overcome the isolation and loneliness that often accompany a quest for personal ambition and self-fulfillment. But the bonds necessary to create community itself cannot exist if all of its potential members remain primarily motivated by self-interest. Hypermodern myth of growth and efficiency locates the solution to these deep and perennial personal and social problems in the realm of free market capitalism with the hope that it can ameliorate or solve any problem. These three cultural values, individuality, growth, and efficiency, both create a cultural crisis and offer a false hope of some kind of resolution to this crisis, implying that these values and their broad acceptance need to be challenged and mitigated on their own terms. This presents a unique opportunity to Christians who believe that the gospel always offers a way of reinterpreting cultures in ways that both enhance it but also challenge it and allow it opportunities to grow into the very things it desires the most. Okay, I get it. I'm running low here on time. Let me just bring up two more observations. One is, I'll just kind of do this. The problem of God in the U.S., okay? Often I'm in conferences, especially abroad, but also here, where people start talking about the challenge of secularism in the U.S. And many times people will tell me that the problem of enculturation in the U.S. is the prevalence of secularism as some kind of anti-religious and anti-Christian bias that must be overcome before any genuine evangelization can take place. So the problem that many people, I think, it's certainly outside our culture, see as the challenge of the U.S. cultural tradition is secularism. And even people within the tradition in the U.S. will talk about the severity and the problem of secularism in the U.S. Now, the problem with that is the U.S. is one of the most, if not the most, religious country on earth, probably next to India, where the most religious country on earth. Every survey done since 1947 demonstrates, and this is actually in my book, so I'm not going to go into all the details, but 95% of Americans every year, on average, over 50 years, believe in God. And they pray weekly. 90% of Americans align themselves with a religious denomination, even if they call themselves an ex-version of it, like an ex-Catholic or an ex-evangelical. They still know what they are or what they were, right? And half of the people in the U.S. attend services on a regular basis, including weekly. This is more than almost any other place in the world. So if 96% of the people in the culture believe in God and pray, then the problem of God, like I used to teach a course to undergrads when I first got out of college, or first was teaching, called The Problem of God, which was trying to prove God exists. But one day I realized no one in my class thought God didn't exist. So I realized what I was trying to prove, you know, I changed the name of the class originally to My Problems with God, because I started dealing with the problems I had with God and the way God structured and organized things. They were less interested in that even than which God exists. Like, why, what would it mean? What are the implications of God for me? And what would it mean? Because, and I just want to read this little quote from the largest study done on American religious attitudes that I know of, at least, or that I think is the Baylor Religious Survey that a lot of us are aware of, that spent 10 years with the Gallup Corporation, New York Times, Pew Research, and Princeton on putting together a long-term longitudinal study of U.S. religious habits, practices, traditions, etc. They came up with, here's their final paragraph of their summation of 10 years of research. American religion seems monolithic. In fact, under the surface, American religion is startlingly complex and diverse. Americans may agree that God exists, but they do not agree about which God exists, what God is like, what God wants for the world, or how God feels about politics. Most Americans pray. They differ widely on whom they pray, to whom they pray, what they pray about, and whether or not they pray for or after meals, etc. But they all pray. A vast majority of Americans are Christians, but attitudes among those Christians regarding the salvation of others, the role of religion in government, the reality of the paranormal, and their consumption of media are widely diverse. So these could go on. And so what I would say is that most Americans, we can say with great confidence that we can, in using Bernard Lonergan's understanding of conversion, which I presume at a place like this I wouldn't have to go into any explanation. Yeah. But anyway, just let me say, go on, that I would say that most Americans have actually undergone religious conversion. In other words, the question is, how does religious conversion relate to other aspects of conversion, like intellectual conversion, affective conversion, and most importantly for our moral conversion and socio-political conversion? In other words, a lot of people in the U.S. culture, in fact, it's not that they don't believe in God, it's that they believe in God without believing that that requires anything else of them. Or that it requires, that there are certain normative things that should be or expected to be, that what the church might have called in the old days justification and sanctification, or we might call initial and ongoing conversion. Many Americans seem to be unaware of the long-standing tradition of sanctification or ongoing conversion. In other words, being saved isn't enough. We have to develop and grow in the virtue and our relationship to God over time. And this requires that Jesus says, what is it that it takes to be part of the reign of God? Love God with your heart, your mind, your soul, and love your neighbor as yourself. You're close to the reign of God if you think this. I think the problem in American culture is most people are not that close to the reign of God. They don't understand how loving God with our mind is a critical part of conversion, or the socio-political dimension of loving our neighbor as self. So, for instance, I think that the challenge in the U.S. culture is not secularism, right? Because on every side of every polarizing debate in this country, everybody on it believes in God. If someone disagrees with me on gay marriage or abortion, they're not non-believers. They go to church, a lot of them. They pray. They believe in God. It's not me against the secularists in debates even about the homeless or about incarceration and these kind of things. It's me against other Christians. Not me individually, but get that. So what I say is that and I refer here to Charles Taylor, who refers to secularism largely as the absence of God in public spaces. You know, that secularism is when God, or people exhausted of religion. I wish we had more secularism in the U.S. I think it'd be very helpful for us as a culture to see that there's some limits to where religious expression and religious dynamic can go without any consequent and subsequent authentication in other modes of conversion. So I think that one of the things is the great challenge here, I mean, there is a secularity that exists here. We do make a distinction between the religious life. We've largely privatized faith, but it's not absent from the public square, nor is it absent from most political and social discussions. It's actually, if you look at the way the Constitution is written, unlike Europe, where they feel often that the government needs to be protected from religion, here, religion needs to be protected from the government and from outside institutions like the university, right? So the problem is here is a whole different understanding of secularism. There's a wall between church and state, and the boundaries are being manned by the church or religious people. So in my opinion, the great problem in U.S. culture is not secularism, but fundamentalism. Fundamentalism is, as my great mentor Don Gelpy and others, occur when individuals and communities have undergone religious community, but not advanced simultaneously in intellectual conversion, affective conversion, moral and sociopolitical conversion. And so therefore, you end up with people, large swaths of American public, who believe that their opinions about the world, because of their genuine religious piety and their genuine religious experience, that their opinions about lots of other things are endorsed by the Almighty. This is a problem and a great challenge, not that all these people are evil or horrible, but that the church has a long tradition of challenging us precisely through the project of spirituality to move beyond mere basic levels of engagement with the divine life through religious experience to a life of sanctification through communities of commitment to ideals of service greater than ourselves. This is our great tradition, and I think that it would really help in a U.S. religious context, a U.S. cultural context, to talk more and more about genuine and authentic religious experience, meaning these broader social types of religious experience that include intellectual, include affective dimensions of conversion, rather than aligning ourselves almost reflexively with anybody who happens to be religious because we think that there's these secularists out to get us. Okay, enough. I'm off my soapbox on that. But I do think that the notion of secularity largely is so different as to be almost not useful in the U.S. cultural context. I really think we'd have to use Taylor to fundamentally reevaluate it. And just because I do want some time for questions, I'm going to move just quickly to my final point, which is the notion that I've always been interested and thought that my model of contextualization out of Steve's book was the countercultural model. So for 30 years, I've been thinking that my theology, that I was alone among all of you, the person being countercultural. It turns out everyone in America thinks they're countercultural. There's this poem by Robert Frost, The Road Not Taken. Here's the great line from this. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Every undergraduate I've ever taught, in the first day of class, I have them read this and write a little bit about where they're at in the poem. I've never had one on the road more traveled by. I'm here to proclaim now today, after my book on liberation, that I, for one, am on the road more traveled by. I've decided that I'm the least countercultural person in America. The problem with the notion of counterculture in America is that at the heart of American identity is Emerson. Most people have never read Emerson now, but it's like not, you can read, you, most of people haven't read Kant or Hegel in Germany, but they're profoundly influenced by the thought of this person who underlies so many of the motifs of the culture, even the language and the way we speak, the way we self-identify. And so we're all Emersonians now. And Emerson's great belief was that every human is, each person constitutes a unique moral universe. And each person is on a unique and totally individual spiritual journey that separates them off from the society in a way that they can only ever participate in it as in a kind of tangential way to their greater search for their own deepest level of autonomy and meaning. Society then serves as a kind of stage in which we work out our deep spiritual path and journey and our own deep individuality. In either case, the problem is that life is seen to be empty, disconnected, and futile, and even boring if an individual themselves, if we don't infuse it with purpose. In other words, the task we have is to infuse the world with meaning. There isn't a meaning or purpose given to it by a God that's easily recognizable or identifiable, as I said in before, that can be shared. That it's precisely, we live in a world where everybody's kind of, it's understandable or acceptable that everybody somewhat has their own God. So there's no way to adjudicate difference, different points of view. And so for it, I think that one of the challenges in a culture like this, I'm running out of time, so let me just say, I think in a culture like this, where I'm free not just to choose my religion, but to choose the past I want to identify with, or even don't think that the past applies to me. Well, yeah, there were slaves, but, you know, I didn't have anything to do with it. Well, of course you didn't have anything to do with it. You know, but to diminish, to not somehow understand that the fundamental idea that what makes a community is that the past is our past, and the future is our future. So that I can say in some real and really clear way, in a way that makes genuine sense to me, that I was there when they hung him on the cross. I was there. That's what it means to genuinely be a Christian. It's to believe that I was there, that the past is my past, and therefore the future is my future. That he rose from the dead means I'll rise from the dead. So taking on a past and a future as a literal sense of identity is what it means to take on a religious identity. But if your whole life is spent trying to be in a culture where doing that, taking on somebody else's identity, is precisely to sell out or to diminish yourself or to let go of the personal quest that you've been given, is extremely... You have to explain why you would do this. Why would you give up on yourself so young, as I was often asked when people would hear I became a priest, for instance. Oh, you're not, and what they meant was, you don't look so bad. You know, you could do better. But I mean, the very idea, you see, that commitment is, and I mean, we see this in marriage, we see it in so many cultural dynamics where that the culture itself that it underlying is that so for us to be countercultural, and here's my greatest problem, is to be counter, if you think being countercultural, now I'm a Dominican, and we have all these vocations who think being countercultural is running around in a medieval habit and singing songs in Latin. But it's precisely if you live in the wealthiest country in the world where they don't need you to ever do anything productive, that you can go do nothing and live off the fat of the land and sing songs in Latin and dress like whatever you want. When I lived in Berkeley, people walked around nude and people walked around in habits. It was all the same. You know, so how is it countercultural? And I don't mean to be mean, but I'm sorry, I've gotten to the kind of this. I think there's a way in which counterculturalism itself has become a kind of a cop-out for what genuine commitment and what would really be most countercultural in this culture, which I think, people are always asking me, point to something that you think's genuinely countercultural. I think that any time I commit my life to some cause greater than myself, greater than I will ever live to see, a cause of universal value that fundamentally involves me beginning something that I won't see completed, spending my life developing a project and working on a common project that someone started before me and that people after me will have to continue to see any advancement in it, and that I commit to completely with my heart, mind, and soul without knowing all the consequences and without thinking that I can leave anytime I want when it becomes unpleasant or uncomfortable, that would be a really countercultural group of people. And I think, therefore, you know, I always point to U.S. religious women, Catholic religious women, sisters, nuns, and religious. I mean, who else? I mean, they're under attack from everybody. The culture ignores them. The church was at war with them. And they refused not to simply collapse or cave in to these cultural press to either be immensely relevant immediately by doing something that would impress whatever group of young people happen to be turning 21 at the moment, or to giving up completely and, you know, just throwing your hands up in despair. And instead, they stayed true, and they stayed boring in a way, right? They worked away at changing institutions. They worked at working on homelessness. They kept running hospitals. They developed different models of delivering education to different groups of people. They changed. They entered in when they were too young to know what they were getting themselves into, often in countries far away. And they came here and they gave their life to people that aren't like them and that over time have changed. I mean, that to me is a countercultural type of thing in the U.S. culture. And so I think that if we're going to proceed in the countercultural model as Bevins lays it out, it requires that not that we advance some kind of new ideas, but that we authenticate any ideas we have with a lifestyle that mainly is about genuine communal life, where we commit ourselves deeply and profoundly to living a life that precisely connects us with a past tradition that is much deeper and richer than my individual life could ever provide, and working for a future, as I say, that only in hope will I ever live to see. And so I would say that the road less traveled by in this culture will necessarily pass through forms of commitment, community, and communion that may seem less countercultural than boring. So that's my great line I use all the time, right? But I would say that the long, unwavering, persistent, and largely unheralded dedication to a cause greater than ourselves, of universal value and import, might be the first step in genuine evangelicalism, and put ourselves in a place where empathy, the first step in moving out of Pharaoh's house into a wider universal and worldwide community, might be possible. Thank you for your attention.
This has been a presentation of Catholic Theological Union. For additional videos and podcasts, or to learn more, please visit www.ctu.edu or visit learn.ctu.edu.